Welcome to Behavioral Health Today, a podcast brought to you by the Triad Network. This podcast is designed to share trending topics occurring within the world and our communities and bring them a behavioral and mental health perspective. Today's topic area is part of our Clinician Series podcast. In our regular podcast, we provide the coverage of a mental health topic of interest, and we find ourselves typically focused on the why behind or the why that drives the work being done in a specific area. The Clinician Series, however, is taking the discussion of topic areas a few steps further, specifically talking with experts not just about the why of their area of expertise, but we'll dive into a more practical, more hands-on, experiential understanding of the what and the how regarding the application of various therapeutic techniques, strategies, and constructs that we'll be presenting. The goal of the Clinician Series is to take our listeners behind the therapy door, to provide a look at and develop an appreciation for what actually occurs in the therapy session, including what gets said, patients' reactions, and the dynamic between the therapist-patient that can occur during the therapy hour. Due to the sensitive nature of today's topic, discretion is advised for younger listeners.
Welcome to Behavior Health Today. I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor. As part of our Clinicians series, we're talking today about sex addiction. Joining me to talk about this subject is Dr. Stephanie Carnes. Stephanie is the president of the International Institute for Trauma and Addiction Professionals and a senior fellow for Meadows Behavioral Healthcare, where she works with sexually addicted clients and their families struggling with sex, love, and intimacy disorders. She is a licensed marriage and family therapist, a certified sex addiction therapist, and a leading authority on sex addiction. Stephanie is a returning guest to our podcast today, and as part of our Clinician Series, we're going to be taking you behind the proverbial therapy door, if you will, giving you a more in-depth look at what patients experience in their work with her. Stephanie, so nice to have you back. Welcome to our show.
Hi, Graham. Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you here. Stephanie, in our first show together, we had some real fun talking about just the developmental process of compulsive behaviors to include sexual addiction and how in their earliest development, these behaviors are typically a go-to as one's best attempt to deal with and cope with stress and isolation, tension, often trauma, and how someone can innocently, really and naively move from a go-to stress release and coping strategy to a behavior that in time becomes a compulsive, addictive behavior and really kind of gets a hold on their life. I want to get into the nitty-gritty of your hands-on work, again, with your patients who really courageously seek treatment with you for their sexual addictions. Before we do, what I'd like to do is to do a two-minute drill with you with three parts. And I'm going to walk you down through just three questions, if I could, to kind of set a framework for our time. That be okay?
Sure, absolutely.
Perfect. Number one, frame for us what defines a compulsive behavior.
Sure. So a compulsive behavior is basically a behavior that develops into a pattern over time in which you are using the behavior to self-medicate, basically cope with anxiety. And that's just similar to like someone with OCD that's using it to wash their hands to cope with stress. It's just a different type of behavior that they're using to medicate, basically.
It is in the service of something, which I want to come back to later on. I know that you help people understand that it is in the service of something and it's an important something. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. So that's one piece here. The second part, what constitutes sexual behaviors becoming an addiction? What's that step that goes over?
Right. And I think what one of the things for your listeners to keep in mind when we're diagnosing, we use the term compulsive sexual behavior disorder, but our clients all, you know, typically refer to this as an addiction. And basically, this is when they're experiencing their behavior is feeling extremely out of control, unmanageable. They're spending excessive amounts of time on the behavior. They have consequences as a result of their behavior. And basically, over time, many of them destroy their lives. They lose their jobs. They just devastate their family. And they feel addicted, like a substance, like we see in substance use disorder.
You're naming some things in there that are unique, but I want to add on to that and have you expand just a wee bit, if you could, and shade it in for us. What makes sexual addiction or this type of compulsive behavior so unique and particularly challenging as a compulsive behavior?
Well, it's the shame around it, first of all. It's It's very, very stigmatized in our population. It's very misunderstood in the media. There's a lot of shame around it, and people feel like they cannot talk to anybody about this. Actually, if you look at the prevalence rates are quite high, but we never, you don't hear about it often because people are very secretive about their behavior because it is so stigmatized and the shame is so high. So them taking a step to reach out to a therapist is a big step for them. And just even talking about it for many of them is very difficult.
Yeah, I really want to highlight at the beginning of our show the importance of not keeping this type of compulsive behavior a secret. It feeds on itself in its secrecy. Absolutely. And the shame builds more and more, and the isolation builds more and more. And it kind of gets its talons into you in a way that is very, very hard to deal with. So I want to just highlight what you're saying. We've got to be talking to somebody about this, somebody that we can trust, and to kind of really, really reach out around this, because that's important.
Right.
You know, there are explanations for this. There are reasons for this. And we know that early life events, including traumas, frequently underlie addiction or this compulsive behavior. You deal with sex and with love and intimacy disorders. What are the presenting histories that you hear from your patients that tend to be unique and distinct to these three disorders?
Right, absolutely. So we have very, very high rates of sexual trauma, first of all. And the research, you know, they've done reviews of the literature and really looked at, you know, summaries of many studies, and sexual trauma history is definitely linked to sex addiction, just as, you know, there's a strong link there. Also, we have high rates of other types of trauma. Emotional abuse and neglect is also very high. Sexual abuse and emotional abuse are a little bit more common than physical abuse. And it's not that that isn't
that you never see that, but
typically emotional abuse and neglect and sexual trauma history is our most common presenting types of trauma. Additionally, you know, we have a lot of our patients coming in from families where there's been some disrupted attachment. We have very high rates of people struggling with attachment and connection with others. So that's sort of a typical background.
Very good. I think that's important for folks to hear and listen to. You know, as part of our show, we have a number of clinicians who listen to our show recommend that the people that they're seeing listen to the show as part of an educational piece to complement and as an adjunct to what they're experiencing in therapy, just to kind of shade in and fill in some other understandings of things I do, you know, with some of the people that I see. And so that idea of being able to address, there are some really unique precursors to this. A sexual history that can be hard, a history where they have emotional abuse or neglect. That's a really important thing. Neglect itself can take a number of forms, and it can impact the attachment piece of how people come into relationships. I'm going to talk about that in just a little bit more too, a little bit later, the attachment piece of this. And our attachment styles in life are very, very important to understand. Are there secure attachments? Are there reactive attachments? Are there ambivalent attachments? So being able to understand that piece too, and how that is impacted by some of these early histories, is really key. But you're saying too, that we know that traumas, whether it's what we kind of sometimes refer to as a big T trauma or a little T trauma, sometimes people think, well, you know, I was neglected and it's not all that bad a thing. Well, if your attachment styles are not there, proper mirroring or proper parental engagement early on is not there, that might not be something traumatic like a 9/11 or a PTSD regarding war, but that's a trauma nonetheless. It's an event outside the realm of normal experience where someone is not getting what some of their emotional interpersonal needs are early on. So even little T traumas, if you just let me label it like that, impacts one's development, including their cognitive development or their sense of themselves or their capacity for empathy and closeness. Maybe they never had any model or mirroring of that. Their attachment styles, like you said earlier, their emotional.
I was just going to say, I can't tell you how many times with this population, we have people coming in saying, I don't have trauma history. And then we start to hear and listen. And it's like they were abandoned. They were never, you know, there was nobody there for them. And that sends a huge message to a child about their importance, their lovability, and has a profound impact. So, you know, sometimes I even think of, you know, if the little T traumas are cumulative and chronic, sometimes that's more severe than some of the big T traumas.
I would really agree with that. Those are almost kind of more kind of a little insidious in a way where they kind of get into someone's life and they're not they're not those big, you know, big block boulders where someone is going, wow, I've got this big trauma that I need to work through. There's an accumulation. Maybe there's some complexity to it as well. So it's a complex trauma with some chronicity to it and some long-term nature to it that really does begin to form a model for the person about themselves and how they come into the world and into relationships. What impact are you seeing having, or really trauma having, in the lives of the patients in terms of how it affects their intimacy and their relational components? How does trauma impact and interfere with healthy intimacy?
Right. Well, it's huge because basically when you're experiencing complex trauma, the message that your caregivers are typically not there for you in a reliable way, or you have to have relationships with caregivers that are unnurturing or unsafe. And so while, you know, as you grow up in that, and while we all desire connection, we want attachment and connection.
Yeah.
It creates a fear there. That these people aren't going to be there for me. And so you see, you know, preoccupied attachment, fearful, avoidant attachment coming out of that. And so they want closeness and they want sex because sex feels like closeness, right?
Sure.
And so, you know, have an experience with a prostitute or pornography, a relationship with pornography or what have you. But then when it's a relationship that matters, and it's somebody that where it requires, you know, ongoing deep connection and intimacy, that's a challenge. And so it becomes a real struggle. So it becomes easier for people to basically act out in some form of their sex addiction than actually maintaining a relationship.
This might be kind of a lead into the next thing I want to get into with you with, but you're saying that seeking sex isn't necessarily intimacy, though it's used at times to seek that unmet need.
Absolutely.
Of unmet connections early on. Connect that for us.
Yeah. So in sex addiction, oftentimes people still, when they are participating in their behavior, they can feel really alone.
Absolutely.
In that process, right?
And why is that often important to understand? Why is that? Because we don't often think about that. Why is that important to understand? Because it's very true, isn't it?
Right. And they're dissatisfied with the experience and it's empty. You know, I'll hear people make comments like, oh, sex addiction, that's the addiction that I want to have.
Right.
And they don't realize the pain that these people are in. It's empty experiences.
Yeah.
It creates loneliness if they're not satisfying for them. And, you know, it just becomes more and more painful as things escalate.
Yeah. So same thing with any addiction. I work with a guy right now who's maintaining a phenomenal sobriety, but he was saying, you know, Graham, at the bottom of the bottle, it's empty. There's nothing there. It's the same thing you're talking about here.
Right.
It's just as empty. It's just as painful
and
difficult.
A lot of times the addicts will mistake, we often tell them that you mistake intensity
Yes.
for intimacy, right?
Right?
And it's not the same thing. And when they get into recovery, they start to, you know, through their work in group therapy, through their relationships with their therapist, through family therapy, they start to expand their capacity for real intimacy and actually start to have sexual experiences that are more fulfilling. Because we know in sexual health literature that feelings of intimacy and connection are the number one predictor for sexual satisfaction,
yes.
Right? And so it's a very important component, but they're often missing that when they're in their addictions.
So as we're talking about this and looking to educate our listeners around this topic area, around what it's in the service of, once you understand in working with the patient, once you understand their history, and you have a greater understanding of the context within which their addiction has developed, how do you guys come in and how do you right size and therapeutically reframe their addiction for them to avoid any further stigma, shame, or any further avoidance?
Right. Well, the first thing that I'll say is that cutting edge treatment for sex addiction involves group therapy. They need to start developing what we call it participating in a culture of support, whatever that looks
Absolutely.
Like for them. Right. And so just connecting with other people, sharing their stories with other people is a super big part of the healing process because they've been living this life of isolation and oftentimes secrecy. which, as you were talking about earlier, just fuels shame and fuels that addiction. When they're in a group with other people going through the same healing process, it's very normalizing for them. It helps them reduce their shame around it and helps them develop more intimate relationships. It increases their ability to tolerate intimacy and expand their skills in that area. And so group work is incredibly important as part of the healing process.
So at first pass, as I listen to that, I'm thinking about coming into your program. I'm going to say, you want me to do what? You want me to open up about this big, dark, scary, shame-based secret? Right. But what you're saying is, if we can just take that step, it's going to be normalized. It's going to be a release. There's going to be a greater sense of, I'm not the only one in this. Some of those things begin to kind of scale off and fall away, don't they?
Sometimes it's scary for our clients to take that step. But then when they do, they are so relieved. Yeah. They feel like that. Usually it's like the first time they're ever talking to anybody about this. And then there's other people doing it, and they have these incredible bonding experiences, and they get more from that experience sometimes than even the therapy process. You know, it's like, it's such an, those bonds that they develop with their peers is huge for them.
You know, there's that saying that says it kind of takes one to know one. And there are some things where that's extremely beneficial, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. For them to be able to talk openly about this with each other and with the therapist, it's like oftentimes it's like what I hear from them is like the weight of the world is off their shoulders to be able to just talk about it for the first time.
And therein lies one layer of hope, isn't it? That if we can just take that step, things begin to kind of shed, and there's a beginning of to see some light through this, helping them understand that it makes sense that their behaviors and the function of it, it's in the service of something important, something that they maybe didn't even realize was impacting them, that they get to go back and take a look at. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Behavioral and mental health professionals provide critical support to our communities in a time when our communities need it more than ever. But they need support too, to continue their education, to connect with colleagues, and to advance their career. And so we've launched Triad, the hub for behavioral and mental health professionals. At Triad, you'll find education, community, and career resources for both current and aspiring behavioral and mental health professionals, all curated specifically for you and all for free. Visit us at hellotriad.com/BHT to register for your free professional account. Again, that's hellotriad.com/BHT. Come join the community today.
How do you, in the process of normalizing some of these behaviors, cause effect, that are kind of the effect of some of the cause of the trauma we talked about earlier on, whether it's sexual trauma or emotional abuse, how do you begin to get down into some of the traumas that folks deal with? And does that come out in the group as well?
Yeah. So what I usually do is we have to do a very thorough history for each client. We do a lot of testing, you know, we use testing instruments that get us a very good history as well. But one of the things that we do is, this is just a strategy that I've used that I found very, very helpful, is we use big sheets of butcher paper. And we have them map out their whole sexual timeline from the very beginning to the present. And they actually share that with their group. So they basically go through, you know, and share like the painful moments. They share, you know, how their addiction escalated, you know, their experiences. And so they see other people's, you know, their lives too. And, you know, they feel known. And then as a therapist, we get all of that great information in terms of assessment and knowing our client's history. And a lot of times it's great material for insights, for the client to make insights. When you look at those patterns and they get feedback from the group, it's a very powerful experience.
So now as I'm listening, at first you wanted me to talk about it. I'm in a group setting and you're saying, I'm thinking to myself, you want me to do what? And now you want me to illustrate it on butcher paper and put it up in front of everybody. But what you're saying again here is that it is healing. There's a release in that, and people are able to get their arms around one another. And it's not a frightening experience, once you get into, begin to lean into it, it's just the initial leaning that gets you there. And then something begins to unfold. That's very, very helpful, isn't it?
Yeah, it's actually funny because it sounds very daunting as I'm talking about it. But actually what happens in the group process is they see other people doing it and then they want to do it. It's one of the very positive aspects of having veterans in the group that are going before you. You bring your new people in and then they're watching some of the other group members share and seeing what they're getting out of it. And then they too want to be a part of that. So it's just part of the magic of group therapy.
Yeah. So the upperclassmen kind of get to pave the way a little bit and maybe demystify.
Yeah. Then they start arguing for having the group time that I want to have. He had more time than me. And
pretty nice to know that. I know that you're sharing with us some of the impact that this compulsive behavior has, and it is empty at the end of the day. It's painful. The intensity of it does not equal intimacy. You're reframing the idea that it's this compulsive behavior is in the service of something very, very important to all of us, and it's a striving for a connection that they've never had, looking to ideally have a corrective emotional experience, but that compulsive behavior is not going to be the path to that. And they're left with just a life that can be devastated and an emptiness that is almost insatiable. Not the behavior so much itself, but what they're seeking. And they're seeking something very good and very worthwhile. And so as we're talking about the trauma that the patient themselves are going through, I know that this addiction, this compulsive behavior, also ripples into the person's relationships, causing some really significant damage and some really significant effects. And I know that a component of your treatment and your program is to work with the partners, their spouses, their families. What are you hearing about the partners, spouses, families, about their experiences, both personally and relationally with the person that they're reporting to you?
Yeah, I mean, the families are devastated by this. Like other types of addictions, let's say cocaine, it's easier for a partner to wrap their head around somebody, you know, escalating in a cocaine addiction. When it's sex addiction, it feels so personal. Like they're choosing another person over me, you know, or another sexual partner or what have you. So it's
like a betrayal.
It's such a sense of betrayal for them. Yeah. And basically what we see is that most of the partners, the research shows about 72% of partners have severe functional impairment when they find out about all of this. And so they're just devastated. They have PTSD symptoms. You know, this is a very traumatic experience for them. And so they're heartbroken and need a lot of support. And so family therapy, couples therapy is just crucial
to
helping, you know, these families get back on their feet.
There's got to be so many important stages to that, just to the acknowledgement of this and begin to try to work through the trauma. I trust that sometimes trauma triggers trauma. Sometimes I would imagine some of the family members in their own backgrounds have had maybe themes of betrayal or other things come up. So now we're talking about kind of a comorbid set of histories and we're working together. And I would imagine as you move down that line of treatment, things like grace and forgiveness and trust rebuilding are going to be parts of the whole treatment program as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's we look at this as a long-term treatment process.
Yeah.
And for the couples and families, it's the same thing, you know, typically a 3 to 5 year healing process and repair process. And that also can be daunting to the new person coming in thinking, oh my God, this is going to take forever. But it's actually realistic because it takes a while for recovery to, you know, for them to learn about recovery and to really surrender to all the principles of that and to integrate that into their lives in every way, which is what is required typically. And then also to demonstrate that that's the case for their partner and for the partner to be able to, you know, express their pain around this and for to really feel heard by the addict. And, you know, that healing process between the coupleship, it's a long-term healing process. And that's just realistic, you know.
Do you guys do group therapies with partners or four partners, like an Al-Anon type? Do you?
Yep, we do. Absolutely.
That's very cool. Give me just a little 2 minute on that one.
Yeah, so it's very, very, again, validating for, because partners feel like they can't talk to anybody about this.
Oh, yeah.
too. Like they will take this to their grave sometimes before even telling their family,
yeah.
right? Because in our culture, betrayed partners are stigmatized as well. Like if you look at like how we treated Hillary Clinton, for example, or other famous partners that have been betrayed, we don't have a lot of a lack of compassion, I would say, to partners' experiences. So they often feel like they can't share it. You know, they feel blamed, you know, that this is part, you know, their fault if they were a better lover or sexier yes. or whatever it is, yeah. then maybe this wouldn't have happened. You know, right. they put this on themselves. And it's extremely painful for them. Yeah. And so by getting into groups with other people that are also going through it, they can feel like they could kind of talk to somebody else about it. So, you know, for partner groups, I recommend that those be small groups. Mm. You know, we tend to keep them no more than six so that the partners can really bond and that they have their own support person and people in place, you know, their own support group, their own therapist
right.
that can help them work through the trauma of all this.
Boy, there's some great components to your program, Stephanie. Those are so healing. We also want to right size a couple of things. One is there is some hope in this treatment and people come out the other end. And I want to talk about that in just a moment too and see what you're experiencing. But there are some very necessary elements to it too, aren't there? There's the educational component to it, this understanding what this is really about, going a little bit deeper to a meta level of this just isn't about sex. It's not at all. It's just one compulsive expression. And in this behavior particularly, like you said earlier, it could be a hand washing. It could be checking something 49 times. It can be a number of things. It can be over-exercising, overeating.
Exactly.
It can be anyone. It just happens to be this one. And this one is unique in some very significant ways, particularly like you're saying, because it occurs more times than not within the context of somebody being in a relationship with somebody with whom they're committed. And that betrayal component and the healing that needs to take place, there's some layers to it. People do get better. People do.
Absolutely.
And the medicine works in this treatment. When folks are getting better, what are they beginning to experience in terms of becoming sexually healthy, both for themselves and within the relationship with their partner? What are they experiencing?
Right. So a lot of people getting into recovery are afraid like they're never going to have hot, healthy sex again. Right?
Right.
It's like they're, you know, they think about it. Oh, I'm going to, you know, not be able to express that part of myself. Yeah. And that's actually not at all what treatment is about. So we individualize everybody's sexual health plan. So, you know, what is healthy sex for one person is not yeah. the same as what is healthy sex for another person. We all have different values. We all have different arousal templates, things that are very exciting for us. And we have different relationships in our partnerships. And each person's sexual health plan has to be individualized.
That's
and
really good.
Very specifically spelled out in terms of this is what I consider unhealthy for me. We use what's called the three circle method. It's a very popular approach to designing sexual health plans for sex addiction. And basically, it's three concentric circles. And the middle circle is the behaviors that you're not going to engage in. And so you kind of outline like, okay, so let's say prostitution, hookups, you know, let's say I've been out of control with porn. Those are going to be the things I'm going to put in there in that middle circle. The center circle. Then the middle circle is boundaries. So the boundaries that you're going to have. So I'm going to put filters on my devices. I'm not going to drive down the streets where I used to pick up prostitutes. You know, you've got to put like the boundaries in place.
Yeah.
And then the outer circle is defining what healthy sex is for you. And initially we do this with the addicts, but then in couples therapy, eventually what I do is I integrate that and do a couples three circle for the couples if they are in relationship with a long-term partner that they're staying committed to, because the partners also are sexually wounded by this.
Yes.
You know, they have a lot of pain around the specific information about the addicts acting out. They might be triggered around some of that. Like, let's say, you know, they find out that the addict always had sex with big-breasted women and they don't have big breasts, or they always went and had prostitutes perform oral sex on them. That those kind of things become triggers and pain points for a partner, right? And so as a couple, we want them to define what's healthy for them. And also, a lot of people are concerned that this is just going to be a vanilla sex, you know, like it can only be one way. It's like, what is really exciting for you guys as a couple? Yeah. What is fun? How, you know, not just genital sex, but also sensuality and, you know, the intimacy aspect, the emotional aspect of it, and also, you know, fun aspects of it. In what ways can this be fun and playful and erotic for you guys? Really defining what that means for them is important.
That's a real exciting component, really, when you think about what they get to walk away with. You're talking about people think it's going to be the, you know, the end of hot, healthy sex. They haven't had hot, healthy sex together. They've never had it. It's part of a compulsive behavior at the end of the bottle. It's empty. It's not fulfilling what they've had to date. And what you're saying is you can have something that's much more intimate. Right. And I'm imagining what you talked about before, that this compulsive behavior is in the pursuit of a deeper need being met around connection. And what you're talking about here, it sounds like in this plan, is where do you both connect most intimately and most deeply? And I would imagine for some, it's like, I've never even thought about that question before. I've never even really recognized even what connection, intimacy really were. But now that I'm understanding it, how might we construct that together as a partnership? That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And it starts with first healing. First, you got to heal the betrayal trauma and the wounding around the betrayal, and then start to redevelop the emotional connection. So this is not a short-term proposition. That's why, again, you know, that takes a lot of work. That could be 2 years, you know? So it can, we don't recommend that the couples don't have sex for 2 years or something like that. Don't get me wrong, but just develop, like, some partners aren't ready, you know, and they're hurt. And so it depends on what's happening for each couple, and we really have to meet each couple where they're at with what's happening with them and try to guide them to greater sense of intimacy, more emotional connection. And oftentimes when the safety and recovery is there, the emotional connection in there, the sex falls into place.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. So, it's born out of that, isn't it? Just naturally, organically. Right. Yeah, really good. Appreciate you kind of going down that path of what healthy sex looks like for the person and what they begin to really probably develop for the very first time. And also what that gets to look like within the context of their partnership. I want to address something just before we're beginning to kind of wind down here, but what would be your message in addressing youth, teen males, teen females, about healthy sexual relationships, sexual intimacy, and what might that look like in their early teen years, and maybe what to avoid?
Yeah. So I think that one of the things that we have to keep in mind for our teenagers is that most of their sex education comes from porn, because we have an early age of first exposure. And, you know, there's typically a fair amount of usage during the teenage years, and that's become pretty normative. And so, you know, in some ways, you know, I can't remember where I heard this phrase, but learning about sex from porn is like learning about driving from watching The Fast and the Furious, right?
That's a great
analogy. Oftentimes not, you know, not always realistic. You know, it doesn't always depict consensual sex. No. It doesn't always, you know, so there are aggressive themes. There are racist themes, you know, and there's also a lot of pressure for performance that, you know, like young men might think they have to have a huge penis and stay hard for hours, and young women feel like they have to look like porn stars. And, you know, what I like to emphasize to adolescents is that sex is beautiful. It can be a wonderful thing. Yeah. And it is about connection and intimacy. Yeah. And, you know, not all of those messages, you can't just take all those messages to heart and expect the same themes to occur that what you see in porn. Like, you know, a lot of kids, they'll see things like, like, you know, rough anal sex or facial ejaculations and expect that their partner who's having sex for the first time is going to be ready to experience that. Right. And that's not typically the case, right? And it sets up, you know, kind of unrealistic expectations. So I think just some education about that is important.
Yeah, you're really reframing. Sex does not equal intimacy. Making love, having intimacy, that's a whole different component here. And you're encouraging them, and it's hard because access to porn and that kind of distorted view of what they're looking at as intimacy or sex is very shaping, unfortunately, in some very negative ways. And ideally, they get some corrective conversations with some healthy adults to reframe the very things you're saying right now.
Right, right. And we don't want to shame them, but, you know, for looking at it or saying they're all, you know, they're all doing it. So it is what it is, you know. It's just like having conversations about what do you want in a partner and how do you want your relationship to look? Actually really asking your partner what they like and what they want and what's pleasurable for them. And communication is really important and things like that. You know, I think that's really important to teach.
Really good. Really good. Well, we're coming near the end of our time, but you are clearly, clearly passionate and having some fun with your work and the folks you're working with. At this point in your career, what is it that makes for the most favorite part of what you're doing? What are you enjoying the most?
Well, you know, I work residential, you know, in my work at the Meadows. And so I get them for a 6-week window. So seeing them when they come in and seeing them when they leave, it's just the transformation is really fun to watch. So I just love that look and how much people can really transform themselves. It's amazing.
Well done.
And I also love in terms of couples work, you know, being able to save a relationship and see it come out the other side. You know, that's an amazing, you know, experience too. So
well done. Well done.
Yeah.
Stephanie, in terms of resources, I would love our listeners, people wanting to find out more just themselves about this sexual addiction, this compulsive behavior that manifests itself this way. How could they learn more about what we're talking about today?
Sure. So if they're looking for a therapist, they can go to itap.com, which is IITAP.com. There's a therapist locator there, and they're all certified therapists. They can put their zip code in. So that's one resource. We also have a website called Sex Help that has lots of information about 12-step resources. In terms of books, we have a website called GentlePath.com. There's some really good books for sex addiction on there. So that could be helpful. I should mention the Meadows, too,
for
treatment. We have a men's program, a women's program, so residential treatment. And we also have intensive outpatients, too.
Very good. I can vouch for all the things you're referring right now. I did quite a bit of review and the resources you have on the sites that you just recommended and given us here are really outstanding. There's some great information for practitioners, for those going through this. And so I appreciate you sharing those with us.
Thank you.
Well, it's been great to have you with us today. Thank you so much for coming back. I know we'll have you again down the road and I look forward to that time as well, but really great being with you again today, Stephanie. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And I want to thank our listeners for joining us today. Triad is so pleased to have the guests we have, and we're pleased that you've joined in. We'll look forward to seeing you next time on Triad's Behavioral Health Today.
We appreciate all the support from our community, and if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Triad Network, all rights reserved.